You're listening to World Affairs. I'm Ray Suarez.
So often making documentaries is the art of being in the right place at the right time, having a camera with you and filming. And this project is certainly the embodiment of that notion.
During the winter of 2020, Daniel Rohr, a documentary filmmaker, found himself in Germany with Alexei Navalny.
Это началось 17 года.
То есть они решили меня грохнуть, как только я объявил, что это президент, они решили меня убить.
The Russian opposition leader was recovering from an assassination attempt, and a journalist named Christo Grozev was helping Navalny figure out who tried to kill him. Daniel and his crew were there filming it all.
So the way Christo Grozev, the investigative journalist, the Bulgarian nerd with a laptop, as he's referred to affectionately by Navalny in the film, the way he works is that he actually leverages Russian corruption to fight Russian corruption. And so what that means is that in Russia today, there is a very lively illicit market for data. So when we say data, what are we talking about? Phone records, credit card statements, passenger manifests. All of these things are personal information that you can buy in Putin's Russia. There are data brokers who will sell you your friend's credit card details or your wife's phone records if you're wondering who that person's been calling. But Christo leverages this data market to piece together the insidious plot of who tried to poison Navalny. And this is what he did masterfully. Using this illicit data, Christo was able to put together the very detailed movements of the members of the kill team. And the way that this method works is that these details include all of their personal information, so Christo has the phone numbers of all these guys.
Rohr's film, Navalny, follows the daily life of Alexei Navalny, his team, and his family during several months in late 2020 and early 2021. Among the most astonishing scenes in the film, one by one, Navalny calls up the men who poisoned him.
I remember I woke up that morning. Christo told me not to have too many expectations. Professional spies and killers who work for the Russian government don't just talk about their plans in this plot over the phone. So let's just shoot it. It could be a set piece for the film, but don't hold your breath. It might not be anything special. So that was the context of which we started shooting. And he was right. For the first five phone calls, nothing happened. Every guy followed procedure and they hung up the phone.
Алло, алло. Это Навальный Алексей вас беспокоит. Хотел узнать, зачем вы хотели меня убить? Какие у вас ко мне претензии конкретные?
And then eventually, Alexei switches his tactics. At the beginning, he was very assertive and aggressive. He says, "This is Alexei Navalny. Why did you try and murder me?" And it was almost to frighten the guy. You could hear on the other end of the phone the panic and the fear, and the poor schlub on the other side of the phone would hang up quickly. But then Alexei changed his tactic, and instead, he picked up the phone, and he pretended to be an assistant of some high-ranking officer in the Russian security apparatus, some high-ranking FSB colonel or general. And he said, "I'm so-and-so, I'm calling from so-and-so's office, I'm putting together this special report on why the Navalny operation failed. Can I ask you a couple of questions?"
Maybe try the prank way.
Okay.
Hello. Hello, Mikhail Mikhailovich.
And he calls up the first guy, and the first guy hangs up. And he calls up the second guy, and the second guy hangs up. And he calls up the third guy, Konstantin Kudratsev, a chemist who is responsible for going into the crime scene afterwards and erasing any trace of poison, of getting rid of any evidence.
I really think a scientist might talk to you. 1% chance.
Okay, let's try to reach some scientists.
Kudratsev not interesting?
And he gives him the spiel, and Konstantin Kudratsev says, "What do you want to know?"
Hello.
Konstantin.
And what proceeds is this 50-minute conversation between Navalny and one of the men who tried to murder him. And Alexei extracts with this brilliant performance. He never breaks character. Navalny extracts every morsel of the plan, every detail, in this stunning moment.
Рассчитали неправильно дозу вероятности. Почему?
Рассчитывали все, я так понимаю, что рассчитывали все с запасом.
Хорошо, скажите, пожалуйста, вот непосредственно механика.
To be in the room and filming that was extraordinary. I just remember the way that the subjects jaws unhinged and hit the floor as they realized what was happening. Of course, I don't speak a word of Russian, but you didn't have to speak a word of Russian to understand that what was transpiring was epic and historic and dangerous. And so I remember sitting there and just thinking to myself, okay, camera's in focus, shot looks good, there's enough battery in the camera, hard drives are okay. Just keep filming.
Do you worry about doing this work in a 2022 where, when presented with this evidence, Russian authorities will just blandly say in reply, "These are fakes. This didn't happen. You taped Navalny just talking into a dead phone," where we're in a world where the Putin government has denied having anything to do with the large number of civilian casualties in the Ukraine, where anti-personnel weapons are being used, civilians are being killed in bunches, and the government simply blandly says, "Not us. Didn't happen. Ukrainians are doing it to themselves to make us look bad." Is some of the undoubted power of that evidence, your material, blunted a little bit by a world where there is now, along with an information industry, an uninformation industry, or an anti-information industry?
The disinformation industry, yeah. Well, first and foremost, you frame that question through the lens of this being 2022. But this has been the prerogative and the game of the Russian state for much longer than that. In 2014, Russian mercenaries shot down a plane, MH17, Malaysian Airlines flight MH17, and murdered, 298 innocent people. And then we saw how the disinformation began then. In 2018, the Russians dispatched two schmucks to go murder a former KGB officer, Sergei Skripal, who was living a quiet life in Salisbury, England. The plan didn't go as it was supposed to. And then we saw the lies that the Kremlin spewed after that. And the same thing happened with Navalny. When presented with facts and evidence, the Kremlin says, "Oh, this is clearly a manifestation of the West." Putin says this is clearly Navalny laundering CIA information, illicit information from American intelligence. So disinformation is part of the framework of how these guys operate. And I think Alexei's commitment to the truth and to journalism and to actual evidence is very important. And I think one of the reasons why that phone call, why filming that phone call was so critical, is because the Russian people, and I think 50 million of them watched that phone call a week after we shot it, the Russian people could see and feel the reality of the moment in a way that a written report perhaps wouldn't convey. And I think that is the power of cinema, to see the faces of these men and women who we have been getting to know over the course of this movie, normally very reserved, Russian, icy, to see their jaws unhinge at the shock of what's going on is extraordinary. And to be a filmmaker who is able to do that work, to be in that room, to capture that moment, you know, there aren't very many filmmakers who get that opportunity. And, you know, it's the great honor of my life having gotten to make a film about these men and women, Navalny, his team, and his family.
We watch as the movie unfolds, a tick-tock, a moment-by-moment unraveling of historical events unfolding right in front of your lenses and narrated, conveniently, by your subject. Did you even realize, when you embarked on this thing, just how explosive it could be?
Absolutely not. When I sat across from Alexei Navalny for the first time, I had to convince him why a documentary would even be a good idea. Here's a man who has an extensive following on YouTube. He has a big, big follow count on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, all of these things. He doesn't need my help to get his message, his story out into the world. And so why then would he need me around? Well, what I was able to convince Alexei of is the virtue and value of a documentary film, how it's different from a YouTube video. One of his investigations is released, it gets 10 million views in a week, and that's it. What I explained is that a documentary comes out on a time delay. It is not going to come out in a week or two, but in a year or two. And more than that, it will have an emotional resonance. If the film is done right, people will be thinking about this man and his family, maybe for the rest of the year or the rest of their lives. And they will hopefully feel a deep emotional connection to this story. And I think Alexei perceived a potential future where maybe he was in jail because he went back to Russia and he's languishing as a political prisoner. And he would need some sort of vehicle to keep his name in the headlines, to keep his name in the global consciousness. And what I expressed is that a documentary film could be such a vehicle. So we started shooting. And I remember the first day, I followed him and his wife as they went for a little walk. And we came around this bend in this sleepy little town in Germany. There was mist in the air and there were cows mooing in the fields. And he came upon this tiny little fence. And out of this little house scampered, like a little stable, scampered a small donkey and a small pony. And Alexei said, "These are my friends in Germany, donkey and pony. Very hard to make new friends here.
Come here, my little pony. Isn't he sweet? Better than your donkey."
And I was looking at this little pony and this, the leader of the Russian opposition in this surreal setting. He was so funny and he was so charming and he's so hilarious on camera and charismatic and he has great comedic timing that I understood that very first day that this film would be unique and this subject was unique. And so the challenge was just being there for as much as I could and also not being too taken with this man. I had to maintain a critical eye towards him if the film was going to work. And so that was very important for the work we were doing as well. And Alexei understood that, Navalny knew that, and honestly, I think he appreciated the integrity of the approach. And to his credit, there was nothing I couldn't ask him about. No subject that was off limits or taboo, even things that were uncomfortable, he was willing to engage on, and that's what made him such a unique subject.
And you felt that he was completely leveling with you? Because once you agree to engage in this way, there is an element of who's using who. You are profiling this man, profiling historic events, getting what you need. Do you also have to think about him getting what he needs out of you?
Absolutely. That's a very smart read, and it's something that my team and I were mindful of from the very beginning. Here's a guy who is a politician, who's seeking the highest office in the world's biggest country. And in addition to that, he is a master of getting his story told, of getting his word out. He's a master of social media, of TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, all of these things. And so I had to be mindful of this dichotomy as we were shooting the film. He knows media. He knows how to manipulate media and get his story out there. So how is he using me? How am I, as a documentary filmmaker, part of his political calculus? And I think that tension of filmmaker-subject and who's directing who is threaded into the DNA of the film. It was really important to me and my film team to just let audiences know that this concern was something that was on our minds. This dichotomy of who's controlling the narrative was very important, but ultimately, my team and I were very firm that we had to have editorial control over the film and final cut over the film, and that must have been nerve-wracking for him.
Well, one piece of perhaps unwanted attention, asked and answered, I don't want to talk about it anymore attention, but he still will be asked and he still has to answer. Early on in his national career, Navalny spoke at a rally that included some of the hardest right of the Russian right, ultranationalists.
Всем привет! С праздником! Слава России! Те, кто собрались здесь, хоть завтра могут...
He has had to handle the association with that rally for years since. How did he explain it to you?
Well, when I asked Alexei about that, he was at first annoyed because he gets this question all the time and he doesn't like answering it because it's uncomfortable, which I appreciate. But it's very important. It must be litigated. Here's a man who's seeking the highest office in the world's biggest country. Scrutiny is demanded of him. And what Alexei told me in response to this question of his flirtation with right-wing nationalism and nationalists is he basically explained that he is trying to build a broad-based coalition to defeat an authoritarian leader. And in order to do that, he has to talk to people and engage with people who are unsavory.
Anyway, well, they are citizens of Russian Federation. And if I want to fight Putin, if I want to be a leader of a country, I cannot just ignore the huge part of it.
Well, I can simultaneously understand that answer and understand why he would make that political decision whilst personally disagreeing with the decision. I would never do that myself, but I understand why Alexei made the decision that he did. And I think that at the end of the day, that complexity makes his character much more fascinating. If people watch this film and feel an ambivalence towards him, I think that is interesting filmmaking and makes him an interesting character in a way.
As we're watching, he and his wife, his family, the team, come to the conviction that he's going to go back to Russia. And you're an observer of events. Were you surprised by that decision?
I wasn't. Anyone who knew Alexei even a little bit, as I did, wouldn't be surprised. There was only one decision, and it was just when to go back. It was never a question in his mind whether or not he would return, and it's counterintuitive. Some people question why, but at the end of the day, he believed that it would be too great a gift to the regime, too great a gift to Putin if he stayed away. Navalny is a Russian politician who felt in his heart that he was not in a position to ask young people to take to the streets, to protest, to risk their lives, their careers, their families, to go speak up against this regime. He was not comfortable asking that of people sitting comfortably in the West, in exile, in Vilnius or Vienna or Berlin. He had to go back because he believed it was his destiny to be the moral leader of his nation. And that meant showing people, by example, that Russians should not be afraid, that evil only proliferates when good people do nothing. And what Alexei, I think, demonstrated by his actions is that he called upon people to not be inactive, to take to the streets, and to lead by his moral example.
But in this case, it's more than just the simple decision to return home. The reason he's in Germany in the first place is because they came pretty close to murdering him when he was on the hustings in eastern Russia. He was just recovered from this poisoning. He could have stayed away longer, and no one would have judged him for it. It makes it even more remarkable, the decision to go back.
To you or I, it's remarkable. To Alexei Navalny, it's unremarkable. He's a Russian citizen. He's a Russian politician. He belongs in Russia. His home is in Moscow. He's done nothing wrong. And so he goes back. But he knew he would be arrested. Of course he knew he'd be arrested. He knew he'd be in jail for a long time. He might not see his children for a long time. He might not get to walk his daughter down the aisle or be there when his son graduates from high school. And that is an extraordinary sacrifice. But again, that's a decision that was made between Alexei and his higher power and his family. And at the end of the day, what I witnessed was an extraordinary strength and resolve, not just from Navalny himself, but from his wife, Yulia, and their children, Dasha and Zahar.
I know that my dad misses Russia, even though it's scary to go back. And if he didn't go back, I would say you need to go back and fight. It's something worth fighting for.
The entire family understood how important this mission was. The entire family supported Alexei and his work. And to witness that show of strength is almost superhuman. It's absolutely remarkable. But I myself wonder whether or not Alexei would go back if he knew, if he could look into a crystal ball and see just how severely the regime would crack down on his organization, his staff, his supporters, and how rough the conditions for him personally would be. I wonder if he would have stayed back away for longer. I wonder if he would have made a different decision. But of course, that's not how history works. Alexei is in prison. He's in jail in a gulag outside of Moscow. He was just sentenced to another 10 years, 9 or 10 years. And so this is the fate that's befallen him.
The events that surround his returning home are handled masterfully in the movie. We are building to a dramatic crescendo, even inside the tight confines of a commercial jetliner heading back to Moscow, intercut with scenes of growing crowds on the ground in the Russian airport. We are on the plane with the Navalny family heading toward Moscow. This is just great, great storytelling. But after all this time with him, you must have had your fears for him as well.
I remember that day very well, the day he went back. I was last with Alexei Navalny on January 17th, 2021, in that hotel that we see in the film in Berlin, Germany. And I remember that morning, and I will remember for the rest of my life. The intensity was palpable. The air was viscous with this thick worry. It was almost as if, you know, it's before a Shiva or a funeral or something like this, this unknowingness, this sadness proliferated through the air, and I could see his staff members looking so gloomy. It was so intense. And through that darkness, Alexei was trying to maintain his buoyancy and his light. And he was trying to be upbeat and tell jokes and all of these things that make Alexei Alexei. But the weight of it was intense. We didn't know what would happen. We didn't know if he'd be hauled off the plane and arrested right on the plane. We didn't know if the plane would be diverted to another city. We didn't know if he'd be shot at the airport. Nothing was certain. Anything was possible. And watching him fly home, tracking the flight radar from Berlin, where I was working and shooting with his colleagues, was extraordinarily intense. And we understood by the end of the evening that Alexei wouldn't get to sleep in his own bed. He disappeared with these five or six men wearing black uniforms into some bureaucratic hallway. And we didn't hear from him for about 24 hours. He sort of disappeared. And the last image we got from that evening is one of the last images of the movie, which is of his wife, Yulia, addressing a crowd of supporters outside the airport. She's alone. Her husband's gone. And she says the most important thing Alexei said this evening is that he's not afraid. And you shouldn't be either. Don't be afraid.
The most important thing Alexei said today is that he's not afraid. Я тоже не боюсь, и вас всех призываю не бояться. Спасибо вам большое за поддержку. Спасибо.
And I think that's Navalny's thesis. I think that's one of the thesis of this film. Don't be afraid. You know, as Alexei says at the end of the movie, evil is only able to proliferate if good people do nothing. Don't be inactive. And I think that statement and that context has taken on an even greater meaning in the world we're living in now. When I released this film, this war in Ukraine was this unimaginable thing. And now we're seeing some of the greatest evil of the 21st century committing war crimes every single day. And Alexei's call to the world remains the same. But more important than ever, don't be inactive. It's only if you're apathetic that this evil will continue to spread its tentacles across the world, across Europe. And it's quite extraordinary to witness from my point of view, having made this film.
Well, history is replete with examples of prisoners and exiles who eventually rise to their full stature and prevail over their enemies. Nelson Mandela, José Ramos Horta was just reelected to high office in East Timor after being one of the leaders of the revolution. Is Alexei Navalny able to still be a leader with power, with influence, able to speak to his countrymen behind bars, anonymous, from time to time hunger striking in a Russian prison?
Absolutely. In fact, I would argue that Alexei Navalny has more power as a political prisoner than he would as yet another oppositionist who has had to flee, who lives in exile. Alexei Navalny, even though he's behind bars, commands a great deal of international attention and respect. He is still active in the world. He has built an organization, the Anti-Corruption Foundation, that is now a global anti-corruption foundation. And his organization continues to operate and has never been busier in spite of being put on the extremist list in Russia. And despite all of his colleagues having to flee and reconstitute their organization in Lithuania. Alexei Navalny is incredibly capable. He's incredibly savvy. And despite his extraordinarily tough situation, he's still managing to be someone who is relevant, who is commenting on global affairs. And it's important to note that Navalny remains to this day the loudest anti-war voice in the country. He is working in whatever capacity he can through his lawyers behind bars. And that takes incredible bravery, too, because he's in the custody of the same men who tried to murder him in August of 2020. But no, I believe Navalny is very effective, and he will continue to be effective until he is eventually released and able to run for the presidency of Russia. Whether he will win, I don't know. Whether he'll be a good president, I don't know. I just hope he has the ability to run in the first free and fair democratic election in the history of the Russian Federation.
Your film was shown at Sundance just a few weeks before Russian tanks rolled over the border and into Ukraine. Does the war change the way it will be seen, the way it will be consumed, the way people will understand what kind of country Russia is?
Absolutely. Absolutely. The war has changed everything. We are living in a different world now. What I would suggest is that the mission of the film has been refocused. The mission of the film now is to remind the world that Vladimir Putin is not Russia and Russia is not Vladimir Putin. This film is to show and illustrate the vivid character that is Navalny and use this thrilling murder mystery, crime-solving thriller of a roller coaster ride that is this movie to remind the world of something that is very serious, dramatic, and real, and that's that an alternate future is possible for Russia. The Russian people do not have to languish in circles of corruption and authoritarianism. It's 2022. The beautiful Russia of the future, as Alexei calls it, is possible, where democracy is part of their tradition, where rule of law and a judicial system are enshrined in a constitution, and where corruption does not rot at every pillar of society. That's the Russia that Alexei Navalny envisions. That's what he's campaigned for. That's why he was almost murdered. And that's why he's in jail now, because he's advocating for this vision.
One very skillful use of the one-on-one, direct-to-camera Navalny is asking him a question at the outset of the movie, which he jumps a little salty at the question. Doesn't act as if he wants to answer it at first.
If you are killed, if this does happen, what message do you leave behind to the Russian people?
Oh, come on, Daniel. No way. It's like you're making movie for the case of my death.
Then we get to meet the guy. We get to look in on his life, on his family, on his mission. Get to know him a little bit. We watch him arrested, we watch him disappeared, and then we come back around to that interview again, and this time he answers the question.
My message for the situation when I'm killed is very simple, not give up.
Do me a favor, answer this one in Russian.
И здесь у меня просто очевидная вещь, ну не сдавайтесь.
Beautifully done, but tell us about that.
Alexei is very uncomfortable thinking about his own mortality. He's very uncomfortable thinking about the possibilities of his own death. I think he copes with the fear of that possibility by ignoring it in a way. And it's so real to everyone else around him. I was aware as I was shooting that interview that it was a possibility that this interview might very well be the last interview he ever gives. And the weight of that was something that I was very mindful of. But of course, it's very uncomfortable and awkward to ask someone to think about their own death, to speak to their family and their people as if they are no longer. You know, of course it's awkward and uncomfortable and bizarre, but I thought it was important because I didn't know what the context would be when this film was released. And I thought it was my obligation and responsibility as a filmmaker to try and imagine what this film might be like if Alexei wasn't with us when it was released. And I think that's why I annoyed him so much by asking him these questions about mortality and his own possible fate. Even though it pissed him off, I thought it was very important. And to his credit, he eventually capitulated and answered the questions. And thank God he did, because I think it serves as the perfect bookend to our film.
Daniel Rohr is the director of the documentary film Navalny, profiling the jailed Russian activist Alexei Navalny. Daniel Rohr, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Been listening to World Affairs, produced in partnership with KQED, with funding from TPG, the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, and from listeners like you. If you want to support the program by becoming a member or making a donation of any size, please go to worldaffairs.org/donate. And we want to hear from you. What did you think about today's episode? Are there any international stories you'd like us to cover? Please send an email or a voice memo to feedback@worldaffairs.org. Today's episode was produced by Matteo Schimpf and Andrew Stelzer and edited by our executive producer, Joanne Jennings. Research and fact-checking was done by Ryan Housel. She's our associate producer. Our technical director is Jim Bennett. Our music is from Blue Dot Sessions. I'm Ray Suarez. Thanks for listening.